And we turn now to Slate legal analyst Dahlia Lithwick. Dahlia, welcome back to Day to Day. And let me just say that my definition of cruel and unusual punishment could vary widely from yours or anyone else's. How does the government define cruel and unusual?
Would that there were a case from the Supreme Court saying here is a humane and considerate way to execute people. Because if such a case existed, all the death penalty states would have a much easier time figuring out how to do this. The problem is we have sort of a negative definition. We have, for instance, we do have the Supreme Court pronouncing several years ago that to execute the mentally retarded is cruel and unusual. They have not been willing, however, to say that executing 18-year-olds is cruel and unusual. So the short answer is we don't know it, but we know it when we see it.
I was interested in Mike's report that a lot of what people seem concerned about is not the actual person who's being executed, but the witnesses to the execution and their reaction watching body tremors and facial expressions and what might happen with the convicted murderer in this case.
It's true, Alex. One of the things that's very interesting in some of the most egregious cases of botched executions, you'll find stories of the intravenous needle popping out and spraying around the room and so horrifying the witnesses that curtains needed to be drawn to sort of contain the mayhem. So part of the problem, I agree, is not simply a test of the suffering of the guy who's being executed, but in fact the sort of increased stress on the people who are watching this play out.
Some people reading about the gruesome nature of Stephen Okun's crimes, and I have read about them, they were utterly gruesome, might say, you know, if this guy were going to suffer through 5 or 10 minutes of pain in the course of his execution by lethal injection, so what?
Right. It does seem a little counterintuitive to be worrying about guys who may feel a flicker of pain when they've done what they've done. But I think it's important to keep in mind, first of all, we don't have a justice system that is only retributive. We have other sort of goals in mind. It's not a complete eye for an eye system. More urgently, the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution does not permit the state to torture people. So although we might like the idea that guys who did horrible things suffer similarly horrible deaths, the Constitution simply prohibits it, and we have to honor that for larger reasons.
It's not about revenge. It's about justice.
Well, it's about justice as defined partly by revenge, partly by deterrence, partly by, you know, a whole bunch of other things. It can't only be about revenge. If it were, we really would be a lawless state.
Dahlia, if this execution does go ahead in the next day or 2 days, it will be the first in Maryland in 5 years. Why was there a moratorium on executions there?
Well, Maryland and several other places have sort of been increasingly concerned about the way the death penalty was administered, a feeling that it was being done in an unfair fashion. And so 2 years ago, the state of Maryland called a moratorium so they could investigate whether that was true. Governor Robert Ehrlich, the current governor, campaigned on the promise that he would lift that moratorium and promptly did 2 years later. The study, of course, proved what we all knew, which is that, yes, in Maryland there is indeed a wide disparity between the numbers of African Americans who are convicted, who are sentenced to capital punishment, and who are in fact executed. And so the answer that Ehrlich and his the death penalty supporters come up with is, well, we knew that. That's not grounds to not execute people. It's a grounds to sort of work to make the system a little more fair. But that in and of itself doesn't justify a complete ban on capital punishment.
Slate legal analyst Dahlia Lithwick. Dahlia, thanks for joining us again on Day to Day.
Thanks for having me.